Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. What makes Oklahoma a special place? What makes Oklahoma, Oklahoma, if you will? That's a question that's been at the heart of a lot of Michael Wallace's writings over the years. It was the subject of a speech he gave in January to Tulsa Town Hall. And from the reaction, then and since, a lot of Oklahomans have also been pondering this question. So much so that Wallace decided to print up a monograph of the speech and create a website where others can weigh in on what our state means to them. The book is titled Oklahoma, A Sense of Place, and the website is oksenseofplace.com. Wallace is hopeful that many other Oklahomans will write about the things, places, and people that create a sense of place for them, just as he did in the book. Wallace is the author of numerous books of history of both Oklahoma and the American West, from books on Route 66 and the 101 Ranch to biographies of Frank Phillips, Pretty Boy Floyd, Billy the Kid, and Davy Crockett. Oklahoma, A Sense of Place launched yesterday, and I spoke with Wallace then. Michael Wallace, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. It's always a pleasure to have you with us.
And it's always a pleasure to be here.
I have to tell you, this little book that came out of your speech at Tulsa Town Hall earlier this year, it reads like a love letter to your adopted state.
Well, it does, but, you know, it's not necessarily a letter that would have been written by the Chamber of Commerce either.
No. Well, we'll get into that. But I want to ask you a first question. What does being an Oklahoman mean to you?
Well, it means many things. First of all, I always like to make the point that I am an adopted, naturalized Oklahoman. And I also like to point out, and we can get into this maybe down the line, that I made the conscious choice to move here as an adult. I wasn't born to this land. And that presents a whole set of other issues and fields of exploration. But what I embrace here, first and foremost, are the people. It's just like on my beloved linear village, Route 66, which of course runs through this great state, and as well as my state of my birth. And well, I've lived in seven of those 866 states, but the most important resource for me on Route 66 or any old two-lane road are the people. You know, you have all the stuff along the road, natural and man-made, you know, blue whales and Grand Canyons and all that. But they don't work without the people. And what I've always been drawn to are the people of Oklahoma. Good, bad, and ugly. Black and white shades of gray. And what I'm drawn to in particular about the Oklahoma people, the purebred Oklahomans, if you will, is their resiliency. And that's what I think I admire the most and what really captured me when I first came here as a journalist snooping around many, many years ago. And then just a few years after that, convinced my new wife at the time, Suzanne, to move here. It was the people and all sorts of people, you know, not just the big name people or the celebrity people or this, that, and the other, but the so-called common folk. In fact, I talk about that in Oklahoma's Sense of Place. The first person I really spent time with in Tulsa was a homeless man. And it had that experience, which I talk about in detail, had a very profound impact on me and actually, I think, on him. And yet I never knew this man's name at all. But
I would think there are a lot of people like that when you've been traveling Route 66 for so long and going to a lot of these small towns.
Right.
There are probably a lot of people like that that have made an impression, and maybe you have the name because you have your notebook, but maybe you don't either.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of nameless influences out there. But the short answer is for the attraction to Oklahoma, the resilient people of this state.
They're tough people. Both sides of my parentage have been here since land run days. And I can tell you, I'm probably the softest member of my entire family. I mean, there's some tough people in this culture.
There are. And Rich, I don't think Oklahomans have used that toughness to their advantage. I don't think they've acknowledged it enough. I think you and I have talked about this before. Certainly I've talked about it a lot with other people, but this so-called shame factor about being a poor Okie or you know, the jokes and the regional humor that you find in a lot of states. I mean, look what they do to our brothers and sisters in Arkansas, and look what we do to New Yorkers. You know, right. We do this regional stereotyping, and certainly that's happened here in Oklahoma. But Oklahomans themselves have sometimes not really acknowledged their own value in the fact that they are tough, that people here have survived the trails of tears. They've survived warfare here. The Civil War in this part of the country was utterly horrendous. They've survived gangs of outlaws and lawlessness, the growing pains of territory.
You have to remember there are also Indian wars out in the West, too, frontier wars.
Incredible wars. Yeah. Incredible wars.
And not really wars, more massacres, really, frankly.
Massacres such as, of course, Ouachita with Mr. Custer. But we've also survived our share of renegade tornadoes and fire and flood and
dust.
Acts of God and acts of man and even a horrendous bombing. And by God, the Dust Bowl was nothing compared to that. We're still here.
Yeah.
And there are people here who did, back in the dirty 30s, spit in the dust and stayed. And those who went on, those pilgrims down Steinbeck's Mother Road, who rebuilt their lives, and many of them have come back. And I think many of them have come back because they have a sense of place and are sort of like monarch butterflies coming home to roost.
My guest today, Michael Wallace, he gave a speech at Tulsa Town Hall earlier this year, and I guess you were besieged by people wanting copies of this speech, so he said, well, let's just put out a little book, a little monograph.
Yeah. It was January 6th. It was my first public reentry because at the end of November, I had much needed catching up with the sins of my youth, a hip replacement. And the good doctor promised me, you will walk onto that stage on January 6th. And by God, I did. It was a full house at PAC, at the Performing Arts Center. I had tailored that speech just for that event. And within, I would say, a minute, I could tell that I had the audience. And I felt very good about what I had written. I felt very good about the delivery. And at the end, I received this sustained standing ovation. And that ovation went on and on and on for days to come and still going on with emails and can we have copies of this speech? And then I gave a variation of the speech at the Ardmore Civic Center for the Noble Foundation several weeks ago. And it was the same reaction. And they've sent copies to the governor and to David Boren, and they said, we've got to get more and more. And I said, just what you said, I turned to my agent and I said, let's just publish it.
Yeah. Well, I think what's interesting about the speech is that it acknowledges the strongness of our character.
Yeah.
It also acknowledges our shortcomings and the fact that we shouldn't really be ashamed of times when we've fallen short, and the fact that if you were here, you were either driven off your land from the East.
Mm-hmm.
And came here under duress for the most part. You escaped here, much like, you know, there's a segment of our culture that's a little like Australia, if you will.
It was
a lawless part. And, you know, we have shameful events in our histories as well as very, you know, important reactions to, say, to the Oklahoma City bombing and other events as well. And we should embrace all of that.
We've got to embrace all of it. You know, when I first moved here back in 1982, I would ask, let's use the word old-timers, people that I thought might be wisdom keepers. I'd ask, it was the reporter's curiosity, I asked them a lot of questions about this place. I was going through that learning process. And when I'd bring up what's commonly called the Tulsa race riot, they would always say, oh, we don't talk about that. And I said, oh, really? And they said, no, that happened so long ago, and let's just forget that. And then a few of them would say, why would you even ask me about that? And I would say, exactly because of your reaction.
Yeah.
Why should we forget about that? Why do we remember everything else? We remember the land runs. We remember that we can't hide what happened. It has to come out into the fresh air, into the light. And, of course, at that time, the only thing was that there was death in the promised land. And right. now, of course, we've seen a steady flow of other books and essays and editorials and acknowledgments.
I want to talk about another incident that you don't hear about, and there's only been a couple books written about that, and that's the Osage Reign of Terror.
The Osage Reign of Terror.
Which, you know, I mean, it is a horrible story, but it's an interesting story. And, you know, I always say we ought to talk about these warts because, first of all, justice eventually was served.
Yes, it was.
You know, these are men who got themselves appointed guardians to Osage Indians because oil had been struck there. And
some even married them, of course.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, they would knock them off and take the money.
Yeah,
and,
it was awful.
And it was awful. But first, it's a very interesting story, and it makes our history come alive. And, you know, I growing up here, you have to take Oklahoma history.
Yes.
Most boring subject in the world because we don't talk about those sorts of things.
And, you know, of course, this is true in a lot of other parts of the country and regions where they have, you know, they're so proud to teach Texas history, of course, in the Texas public schools. But believe me, they don't tell the real story of the Alamo and about the slavery factor and talk about unreconstructed Confederates coming down and the horrors of the Reconstruction period. They don't acknowledge any of that. I think most states and then through their schools tend to present this, as you say, whitewashed. It's gotten better than when I was a kid. You know, we're no longer talking about George Washington chopping down cherry trees and throwing coins across the river, but there's still room to improve.
The other sense of this book that I think people should take away from it is this entrepreneurial spirit that's been a part of our history. And I think, you know, I've been talking in Tulsa about how for about 20 or 30 years, we kind of lost it.
We did.
And now it's coming back now.
You're exactly right. And here's what I notice, and this isn't because I'm that smart. It just became obvious to me. We had these risk takers back in the so-called boom days when we were the true oil capital of the world. Guys with sixth grade educations, these macho men, you know, Skelly and the Phillips and Sinclair and all that, who invested a lot of money in this city because they wanted a good place for their families and their workers. And so there was a lot of that going on. But then we went through this whole status quo period, you're right, where a lot of their descendants sat on their hands. Even though this continued to be a very giving city, it always has been philanthropically. It's kept a lot of institutions, including this great radio station, going. Yeah. And that's important, and I acknowledge that. But what I've noticed in the last X amount of years is the primary forces behind keeping the city going now come from our wonderful Jewish community. These are the sons and daughters of refugees from Russia and Germany who have come here, you know. And that's so names like Zarrow and Kravis and obviously Kaiser. These are really important names. And you talk about entrepreneurial. It was their people who came here, and a lot of them starting all over again. You know, starting one of them had been a member of the Reichstag and came here and had to start all over again. And look what they've built and look what they're giving back to this city. I mean, all credit has to go to that sector of our community.
And I think it's also sparked, you know, we've seen what's happened in Oklahoma City. They've revived their entrepreneurial spirit.
Yeah,
I think it's happening here again with, you know, a new generation of risk takers again.
You know, I sound like this cheerleader. I think that we, Tulsa, are right on the verge, if not into an artistic renaissance. I notice it in so many ways. One example is This Land, this great publication, and those young men and women putting that together in this multimedia force. People like Sterling Harjo.
Filmmaker.
Coming in here. Great, great filmmaker. Joy Harjo, another great poet and writer moving back to Tulsa. The Hanson boys building their little compound out in the Osage Hills. They could be living anywhere. I could be living anywhere. A lot of us could, but we choose to live here. And I think it's just fantastic. And this is the moment in Tulsa's history that I have been waiting for since we moved here 30 years ago.
My guest today is Michael Wallace. His new book is a monograph of a speech he gave at Tulsa Town Hall earlier this year in January, titled Oklahoma, A Sense of Place. One of the things I like about this is, you know, maybe the transplant can see, you know, you talked about worrying about being a cheerleader, but,
right.
you know, I think native borns, we tend to see the things that, you know, don't measure up and perhaps don't appreciate the good things. And I think a transplant has a more balanced view. I'm certainly the things you'd still like to see changed about this culture, but there are a lot of good things too.
Yeah, no, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's like we're talking like the most vehement member of a congregation is that recent religious convert. Yeah. They're the ones that really get into it. It's not just rote to them. They're really passionate. And I have this passion for this place. And again, I think this is true of a lot of places. You know, how many New Yorkers really know, you know, how many of them have been out and really know the story of the Statue of Liberty? You take a lot of things for granted where you live. You can't see the forest for the trees. And I've learned a lot of this just with all my efforts on Route 66 over the years, convincing city fathers all up and down the road, government leaders, bureaus of tourism, chambers of commerce. Look, you have a resource right here that you're passing. It's instant money. It's economic development. It puts vehicular traffic in your state, in your county, in your city.
You know, you mentioned the New Yorker analogy.
Yeah.
You know, for every New Yorker that, you know, doesn't know and sort of hates the heat and bustle yeah. and you know, the yeah. noise of the city, there's another New Yorker that can tell you everything about everything, the best place to get the best steak,
that's
the
right.
best place to get the best pastrami on rye,
right.
You know, the best little park, pocket park.
Yeah.
And we need more of those ambassadors, I really think.
Oh, yeah. Again, it always gets back to what I said before, the people. And no one can tell the story of a place or an entity or any better than the people involved with it. And that's certainly the case here in Oklahoma. You know, the thing I always talk about is our friends south of the Red River in Baja, Oklahoma. I've said this many times. If you take a yuppie, I don't know what we call them now, but out of a glass tower in Dallas and a grease monkey from under a car in Fort Worth and put them in a conference room in the Metroplex, they seemingly have nothing in common, but they do have something
in common.
We can
talk about Texas.
They are proud to be Texans. Sometimes way too proud. But we have that same ability and need to have that pride right here.
And you think do you think we still have an inferiority complex as a state?
I think somewhat, but it's gotten better. You know, there's one talk that I've done many times just about, please read The Grapes of Wrath. I mean, really read it. Don't just criticize it without reading it and find out about true resiliency. This book that was banned in Oklahoma and in California, but that really speaks to the resiliency of the Oklahoma people more than anything else. I mean, there's no finer character in 20th century literature than Ma Jode. And the soliloquies of Tom Jode when he's leaving that camp in California, it should be embraced. We had a former governor here whose son is now mayor of the city who was proud of that word Okie. People don't realize that Okie didn't even come out of the Depression. Okie was first used here when we became a state. It was coined in 1907. But Okie is not something to be ashamed of.
I came from parents where those were fighting words, though. You know,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's absolutely
yeah.
true.
Yeah.
And you mentioned The Grapes of Wrath. Woody Guthrie. You know, and I think this is a sign of how we're changing.
Oh,
you know, he was we didn't want to have anything to do with him for so long, and now I think the state is finally beginning to embrace him.
Finally. Well, finally we had enough funerals down in Okemah that all those naysayers at rest.
Well, they weren't all in Okemah either.
They
were plenty in Oklahoma City and Tulsa, too.
Yeah. I remember an early Guthrie show from the Smithsonian that was stopped by the powers that be in Oklahoma City, except for the courageousness of Bob Blackburn. He brought it in to the Oklahoma History Center. That Bob Blackburn, who looks like a mild-mannered little man, he is a tiger. And we have those kind of tigers left in the state. Yeah, Guthrie. One of my most beloved moments in my existence here in Oklahoma was several weeks ago during that Guthrie Centennial, much of it here on this campus, when I'm standing on the stage with the Hansons, with Nora and Arlo, with Jackson Brown, and we're all singing This Land Is Your Land. And I look out in the audience and I see children and I see Woody's baby sister. and the whole audience is caught up in that moment. And Woody really came home that night.
Yeah. My guest today is Michael Wallace. His new book is titled Oklahoma, A Sense of Place. And we've talked a little bit about the book and sort of the themes behind the book. But you have this interactive element that you want people to share their own stories of what
right.
what sort of place this place is, Oklahoma.
Right. Well, along with this, the electronic book and actually hearing my voice or getting a tangible copy from Amazon or wherever you want to get it, we also have a website that people, and I want them to come to it, I want them to flock to it. It's just simply called OKSenseOfPlace, all one word, .com. And I want to hear from all of the people out there, all of you. What is your sense of place or places? Because I have a sense of place about my native Missouri, about northern New Mexico, about hunks of the Mother Earth. And I think it's very legitimate and apt that you do have more than one sense of place. But whatever it is, if it's one sense of place, if it's many, if it's a city, if it's a state, if it's your neighborhood, perhaps it's a church,
maybe a diner.
A beer joint,
a donut shop.
It could be a donut shop. There's a lot of sense of place. I want to hear from you. I want to hear from the readers about that on this website. And if you can send pictures, there's nothing like it. And then what we'll do is cull through them and come fall, start going out with these people and doing little film stories about their sense of place. I want to bring them into the party. So I'm really looking forward to it.
All right. Well, we wish you great success with that. Michael Wallace, always a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us.
I really enjoyed being with you again.
Michael Wallace speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's the author of Oklahoma, A Sense of Place, which launched yesterday. And you can learn more at his website, OKSenseOfPlace.com. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. One of our great legacies in Oklahoma has to be our Indian ballerinas, Maria and Marjorie Tallchief, Rosella Hightower, Yvonne Shoto, and Mosalyn Larkin. Of course, Miss Larkin, ballerina with the Ballet Russe, the co-founder of Tulsa Ballet, died 2 weeks ago at the age of 87. Our commentator Connie Cronley worked intimately with Miss Larkin for many years at Tulsa Ballet and has this remembrance.
It seems fitting to me that Miss Larkin died at 11:30 at night in late April. 11:30 would be about the time dancers are leaving the theater after a performance. Late April is about the time the ballet season is over and dancers are off for the summer. Mosalyn Larkin was a consummate ballerina, artistic director, and ballet teacher, so 11:30 at night in late April seems the right time to close a life in ballet. I worked closely with Miss Larkin and her husband, the late Roman Jasinski, for the 15 years I was general manager at Tulsa Ballet Theater. We seemed to work around the clock. We traveled together, went on tour together, had dinner and parties and galas together. It was one of the most fascinating times of my life. She is renowned for being one of Oklahoma's famed Indian ballerinas, for performing with the Ballet Russe, for operating the Tulsa School of Ballet, where she taught little girls to dance with bluebirds in their fingertips, and for founding Tulsa Ballet Theater, where she and Mr. Jasinski spun straw into gold. They were experts at doing a great deal with nothing. At the finale of Capella, when the dancers carried in a huge golden bell, they had to be careful to keep the side with the huge hole in it out of the view of the audience. In the early days of Tulsa Ballet Theater, she helped sew the costumes and paint the scenery. For most of the time, the costume department was in her garage. She cooked the seamstress's lunch every day, then went to the studio to teach class and rehearsals. In her performing days, the Ballet Russe tours were more grueling than glamorous. They often danced in wretched conditions, so she was sourly amused at contemporary dancers' demand for specially built dance floors. She said that dancers of her era walked the stage before a performance to learn where the holes and nails were, so they could dance around them. She had danced all of her life, from the powwows with her full-blood Shawnee Peoria father to dance class with her Russian mother, Eva Matlakova. I got to see Miss Larkin behind the scenes, where the hard, gritty, sweaty work is done to make the beautiful, effervescent ballet performances. She worked hard, then played. She loved to watch Gunsmoke on TV, and she loved to go to the beach in the summer. She was petite, always immaculately dressed, and she had the greatest sense of joy of anyone I've ever known. On our way to a ballet conference in Laguna Beach, California, our rental car broke down, and she and I sat on a curb for almost 2 hours waiting for a replacement. She considered that, and every hardship, a great adventure. At another conference in Kentucky, after a long and tiring day of meetings, she jitterbugged half the night with Alan Jones, the artistic director of Louisville Ballet, while I yawned and longed to go back to the hotel. Once, the Jasinski's home was on the Tulsa Garden Tour. They didn't have much time for gardening, so the day before they rushed out and bought flowers and plants. When the Garden Tour visitor asked her the names of the plants, Miss Larkin had no idea, so she would say, "Well, now, I don't know what it's called in English, but the Russian name is," and she made something up. Everybody was happy, her too. She had the creative solution of filling out the empty spots in the garden by stationing costumed dancers standing in classical ballet poses. Miss Larkin was extraordinarily beautiful and charismatic. Her radiant smile could light up a city, and it did. No wonder, after her performance at London's Covent Garden Theatre after World War II, the English press said, "She is the first ray of sunshine this war-torn nation has seen." And yet, in her demands for precision, she could be terrifying to young dancers. I remember a dress rehearsal at the Performing Arts Center when she yelled out to the corps de ballet of about 18 girls, "Will the stupid girl get in line?" And every girl on stage took a step forward. Miss Larkin's mentor was the great Russian prima ballerina assoluta Alexandra Danilova, equally tiny, charismatic, and powerful. Madame Danilova said, "In Russia, we were taught never to touch our knee on the floor when taking a bow, unless there was royalty in the house. We were to kneel only to royalty and to God. But at my farewell performance, I spread the roses that had been sent me on the stage in front of me, and then I went down on my knee in gratitude to the audiences who had given me my career." At 11:30 at night in late April, Miss Larkin made her farewell, not on stage, but in a nursing home suffering from Alzheimer's, in Tulsa, in Oklahoma, and in the ballet world. The curtain came down quietly. Brava, Miss Larkin. Brava.
Connie Cronley, remembering friend and former colleague, Moselyn Larkin. Connie's a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. That's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher.